For more than 2 years, the Apostle Paul was in Roman custody. Most of that time in the Roman fortress at Caesarea by the seaside. His forceful defense before the governor Felix, 2 years and more before the events of which we have read, left some hope that Paul would be acquitted of any accusations against him, and that he would be released back into the liberty in which he had spent most of his years. It was not to be. Felix had frequent communication with Paul during that time, but always with the hope, as we learned, that someone would deliver enough money to the governor to enable him to look the other way while others ordered the apostle's release. But neither Paul nor any of his colleagues desired that kind of involvement in the rank and frequently violent corruption of the imperial administration. When the order came from the court of the Caesar to recall Felix to Rome, he had one last opportunity to order Paul's release. But Felix wanted to gain greater favor from the Jews, perhaps to mitigate some of the charges for which he was summoned to Rome. And so he left Paul where the apostle had spent the previous 2 years. The weeks passed, and there were those occasions when Paul went in to meet with Felix. But since no one was willing to pay a bribe, Paul remained in custody. Now, his custody, as we understand it, was not especially at this point onerous, but he had no liberty to leave and to return to his missionary endeavors. And then came the news that a different man was to take the place of Felix. And as the ship that carried Felix sailed out into the Mediterranean from Caesarea, those in custody in the fortress had to wonder about their treatment at the hands of the successor to Felix. But the Jews saw their opportunity as well. They felt deep frustration that they could not bend Felix to their will. And they thought that with his successor, they may have a better opportunity to pry Paul loose from Roman custody and to get him back in the hands of the Jews in Jerusalem. What they really wanted, of course, was to kill Paul, to destroy him, and to put an end to his continuing influence over the adherents of Judaism in Jerusalem. They thought it was an easy issue for the new ruler, the new governor, Porcius Festus, to resolve. He would remand Paul to Jerusalem for trial there, possibly even before the Sanhedrin, and the Jews would ensure that Paul would never arrive in the city. But Paul was not just any prisoner. There were no formal charges against him, at least none supported by any evidence. Still, as too frequently happens in our country now, political considerations descended into the conduct of a judicial proceeding. Does that sound familiar? It's nothing new. Like Felix before him, Festus regarded the Jews with a curious mixture of loathing and favor. He detested their tactics and their religion, but he knew he needed them, and he needed their favor if he was to survive and prosper in his new position. Somehow, messages of civic misconduct by Roman officials always found their way to the ears of the emperor. Now, how that happened, we do not know, because there was no internet, there was no social media. We don't know how it was, but somehow that news always got there. But for Paul, the bottom line was that he was not answerable to the Jewish council, and he knew that his rights as a Roman citizen must prevent any attempt to deliver him to Jewish judgment again. So it was that Paul came to one of the major turning points of his life. He diverted the subtle efforts of Festus by asserting his right to a hearing before Augustus himself. That man at this time was Nero, certainly one of the most abominable people who has ever governed in the world. Paul asserted that Festus had no liberty to place Paul at the mercy of the Jewish council, or as we read, no man may deliver me to them. He directed the attention of Festus to the central issue in the proceedings. It was a question of jurisdiction. A question of jurisdiction. And I want you to think upon that theme with me today. Such questions arise when parties to a dispute try to decide where the dispute shall be judged. Jurisdiction is a legal concept that determines who has the authority and the responsibility to render such judgments. For example, the Superior Court of Maricopa County, where we reside, does not have the authority, the jurisdiction, to decide disputes in Mojave County, out in the western part of our state, or Gila County, up in the mountains, any more than the courts in those places have that authority to act on matters that arise here. The Supreme Court of the United States in most cases exercises strictly appellate jurisdiction. That is, it considers cases that other federal or state courts have decided. In the event that a party to a dispute files an appeal of a particular decision. In the case of Paul the Apostle, there were two primary areas of jurisdiction. One was the Sanhedrin, the council that represented the religious leaders of the Jewish people. There were priests, there were rabbis, there were Sadducees and Pharisees, as we have seen. And at one time, Paul was a member of that body. The other area of jurisdiction was that of the Roman Empire and all of its administrative divisions. Generally, to gain access to that jurisdiction, a person had to be a citizen of the empire, a status that most people achieved by payments of large sums of money. But those who, like Paul, were born as Roman citizens had what we could call today the gold standard of access to the Roman tribunals. They could not be turned away. And I'm sure that when Festus consulted with his council, they told him, "You cannot do anything else but grant the appeal." These two areas of jurisdiction collided in the case of Paul, and Felix, the previous governor, could not figure out a way to overcome the situation, because Paul's status as a Roman was intertwined with his position as one who was also born into Judaism. He was a Roman and he was a Jew, and Felix couldn't sort that out. But Paul recognized that the ultimate cause of the conflict was that he was a follower of Jesus Christ. You see, there would have been no issue between the Jews and the Romans concerning him apart from that fact. The Jews would have had no problem with Paul. And the Romans would have had no problem with Paul apart from this fact. He was a follower and, as it happened, a preacher of Jesus Christ. Paul also recognized that his status as a Roman citizen gave him a huge advantage in this situation, in his dispute with the Sanhedrin. The imperial government considered it a high priority in its policy to protect the citizens of the empire from the actions of those who were not citizens. You could almost wish for such a sentiment to be revived in our land in these days. Paul knew that only the imperial power had the jurisdiction in his case, had the authority to pass judgment on him. But he also knew something else. He knew, beyond any doubt, that it was the purpose of God for him to travel to Rome. He had one more journey to make, and that was a journey to Rome. And he knew that God was purposing to send him there so that Paul could preach the gospel of Christ in Rome as well. So I want you to get this, that the decision to make an appeal to the Caesar was not, on Paul's part, an impulsive fit of pique. He was not reacting and saying, "Well, I'm going to show you, Festus, I appeal to Caesar." There. No, I believe that his appeal represented Paul's realization that here was the path on which the Lord was going to take him away from all of that and to the very capital of the empire. So in all that transpired in this passage, the will of Christ was paramount in Paul's thinking. And Paul's resolve to be in the center of that will for the glory and advancement of Christ's kingdom was what guided him. It's well for us to observe that example. Now, Paul could not know all that would be entailed in his appeal. He did not know all the specifics of the results of his act. But he knew that he was in the hands of the Lord. So in these verses, we find four things to consider. First, a new judge. A new judge. There's a definite transition from chapter 24 to chapter 25. As we have already observed in speaking of Felix, Roman officials were not known generally for their uprightness of character. Many of them could run for office in our country today. And in the swirl of imperial politics, there were always those who were anxious to advance their own causes at the expenses, or literally in many cases, over the bodies of others. If there were no hard facts in a case that could be argued, then rumor and innuendo were often sufficient to compel the emperor to order the removal of an administrator, whatever his title was. Now, like others who received positions of authority in Palestine, Felix found himself in a political tinderbox. No one had a good time when they were posted to Palestine. Jewish resentment against the occupying power, together with the typically corrupt way in which Felix exercised his authority, ensured that people in Galilee and Judea would be looking for any opportunity to accuse Felix to those above him. And so reports went back to Rome during the tenure of Felix, and they kept sending these reports. Well, a lot of times in Rome, these reports were treated as the latest irritation, the latest flea bite, if you will, from that far-off province where people in Rome hoped that they would never have to go. But when they kept coming, they tended to create more problems. And finally, they reached a critical mass. And some say that the last straw was that when some of the Jews engaged in an act of rebellion, Felix ordered the Roman soldiers in to slaughter them. And there was a huge loss of life. And some say this for the emperor was the last straw. So he appointed a replacement and summoned Felix to be brought back to Rome to answer the charges against him. The new man was Porcius Festus. We read his name for the first time in the last verse of chapter 24. Now, some have suggested that it was the wife of Nero who urged her husband to recall Felix and to send Festus in his place. That would not be out of keeping with the way decisions were made in the capital of the empire. Festus died in office, and his successor began his administration, by the historical record, in 62. So since Nero became emperor in 54, it is likely that these events took place somewhere around 58 or 59. Now, for whatever reason, Festus seems to have had a better reputation than did Felix. But in terms of Paul's case, it didn't matter. The outcome was no different. You ever wonder what Paul thought about all of these changes? We don't know. Paul was a prisoner. He was in custody. Maybe he heard some of the rumors that swirled through the place. But he was a prisoner, and he was a prisoner in limbo because there was no clear charge, no clear bill of indictment against him. So he had very little say in anything that happened concerning him. If the order came to move him from this part of the fortress to another part, he moved. We learn at the beginning of this chapter that Festus arrived in Caesarea where Paul was in custody. And no doubt this arrival was a matter of some ceremony. Then that Festus spent 3 days in Caesarea getting settled before he headed up to Jerusalem. He ascended, we read, to Jerusalem, even though the direction on the map was down. He was going to the southwest, but as we have noted, Every journey to Jerusalem was up. So he ascended to Jerusalem. And whatever Paul's thoughts were about all of these activities, we don't know. But we do know what the leaders of the Jews thought. They saw here a golden opportunity that in the transition, they might have a chance to get Paul back in their hands. And that's the second thing that we find in this passage, a refurbished plot. You may remember that there had been a conspiracy more than 2 years before to murder Paul. When the first effort to murder him in the temple courtyard was interrupted, they formed another conspiracy, and it was to prevent that conspiracy from being fulfilled that Paul was removed from the city. Festus now arrived in Jerusalem. Think of him, he's only 3 days in the country, 3 days at Caesarea, then however long it took him to get to Jerusalem, maybe a day or so. He arrives in Jerusalem, and immediately the Jews descended upon him. No doubt welcoming him, wishing him well in his time in office there. But immediately they said, "You have a prisoner, Paul. He's being taken away from us. We want him to be brought back." Claudius Lysias, the chief captain 2 years before, had foiled the conspiracy to murder Paul by ordering him to be transferred to Caesarea. And I think it is evident that during the 2 years and more that passed, the members of the Sanhedrin had been harboring bitter resentment. You get some sense of that if you look back at chapter 24 and verse 6, where Tertullus was speaking before Felix, saying, "Who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law, but the chief captain Lysias came upon us and with great violence took him away out of our hands," suggesting that somehow he had done wrong. Well, during these years that Paul was in custody in Caesarea, the members of the Sanhedrin evidently never forgot. They talked about it, thought about ways in which they could gain access to work their will. So here they had taken the earlier plot that had been foiled, and they refurbished it. They weren't going to rely on a conspiracy of 40 of the baser people of society. They were going to take the matter into their own hands. So they said to Festus, "We would like..." I'm sure they said, "Noble Festus, we would like for you to arrange for Paul to be brought back to Jerusalem so that we can interview him again before our council." But we read the Holy Spirit's comment that they were going to lay wait in the way to kill him. Somewhere along the road, they were going to take his life. This word in verse 3, laying wait in the way, is the same word that we saw in chapter 23 and verse 16. When Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. And that was a reference to the conspiracy. where in verse 12 of that chapter you read, "When it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. And there were more than 40 which had made this conspiracy." They went to the chief priests and they told them what to say. This is a word that conveys a very vivid picture. It's the idea of setting an ambush. They were going to lie in wait. They were going to, at some place in the road, going up to Jerusalem, they were going to be hidden out of sight, so that when Paul and whoever was accompanying him arrived there, they could surprise them and overwhelm them and kill the apostle. So here is the unrelenting resolve of the Jews. Here was the opposition to the ministry of the Apostle Paul. They wanted it ended. They wanted the defections from the synagogues and from the temple worship to stop. Think about the impact of Paul's ministry on what went on in the temple. Do you suppose that after the Lord Jesus Christ removed the money changers and the sellers of sacrificial animals from the temple, do you suppose that they didn't come back? Well, you would be wrong. They came back. But now, because there were so many losses to Judaism, there were not as many people to buy these animals. Not as much need for converting money into temple money. All because of Paul. Sort of like the impact Paul had in Ephesus on the trade in the shrines of the great goddess Diana. But more than the economic impact, which no doubt they resented bitterly, was the loss of prestige for the Sanhedrin. And they blamed Paul for everything. And they wanted him dead. And here, they thought, was their chance. Change in administration. It would take Festus a while to get used to things. And before he does, before he knows what we're really about, we'll have done away with Paul. But Festus saw through them. And he declined their requests. Notice in verse 4, Festus answered, "Paul should be kept at Caesarea." He could see where the discussion was headed. And Festus did not want to begin his time in this position as being responsible for the death of a Roman citizen in Roman custody. So he said, no, we're not going to bring the proceedings here. We're going to go to Caesarea. And as we were reading at the outset earlier, I noted in particular that Festus got some digs in at the Jewish leaders in verse 5. He said, "Let them therefore which among you are able," suggesting that not everybody fit into that category, "go down with me and accuse this man if there be any wickedness in him," suggesting that there was great doubt on that score. And then notice in verse 6 that he said, we'll go to Caesarea, but then he tarried among them more than 10 days. He wasn't really feeling the urgency of making the trip. So he said, "I'll hear what you have to say, but it's going to be on my terms." So he went down to Caesarea finally, and we don't know whether the Jews went ahead and had to wait for him there, or whether they went right behind him. But we find that eventually Festus arrived back in Caesarea, and in verse 6, the very next day, he commanded Paul to be brought. Festus sat on the judgment seat. He sat on the bema. He sat on the place that represented Roman authority and sent for Paul to be brought before him. And we read that the Jews were ready, or so they thought. And that leads us to the third thing in the passage, which is a perilous proposal. It's a very vivid picture that emerges in verse 7, that when Paul came, no doubt seeing him in person for the first time in over 2 years, took their bitterness against him and against the Romans to an even higher level. But when he was come, the Jews, which came down from Jerusalem, stood round about. The idea is they were almost in a circle surrounding Festus on the judgment seat and Paul, the prisoner there. They stood round about and laid many and grievous accusations against him. This is a terrible person, Festus. This is a troubler of the peace, Festus. This is a seditionist, Festus. But we notice the Holy Spirit's commentary in verse 7, which they could not prove. Festus could say to them, "Where's the evidence? Produce the evidence." They went to other accusations, like those who said concerning Jesus before Pilate, "If he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him to thee." Don't ask us for proof. But this was not the Sanhedrin. This was a Roman court. And Paul got the opportunity to defend himself. And when he got the opportunity to defend himself, in verse 8, he reviewed the three levels of law that were in controversy. He said, there's the law of the Jews. Paul said, "I have not transgressed the law of the Jews." He had been in Jerusalem going through a ceremonial ritual to demonstrate that he was not overthrowing the ceremonial requirements of the law. So he could say, "I haven't transgressed the law of the Jews." And he said then, "There's the law of the temple. I haven't transgressed that either." Because that was the charge. He had brought a Greek with him into the temple, because they had seen him with a Greek, a man from Ephesus, previously in Jerusalem. But he said, "No, I have not offended the law of the temple." And then he said, "There's a third area of law. That's the law of the Romans, the law of the Caesar. I haven't offended anything against that law." So he is saying he was innocent on all three levels. Now, right there, that should have been the end of the story. But then Festus, taking a page from Felix before him, said, "Well, Paul, will you go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me?" Why did Festus do that? Well, he sensed, just like Felix did, this is a difficult situation. How am I going to get out of this one? How am I going to extricate myself from this one? How am I going to avoid the fate that befell Felix? So here Paul was being asked willingly to go back to Jerusalem, to go back into that very situation from which he had been extricated, so that Festus could get in good with the Jews. And certainly Paul understood what that meant, because in verse 11, He said, no man may deliver me unto them. And there was the suggestion then that in going back to Jerusalem, Festus, not without his supervision, but certainly in a real way, was going to hand him over to the judgment of the Sanhedrin again. And if Paul had agreed to that suggestion, he would never have reached Rome. And how was Paul being guided in his thinking? Now, this proposal is put before him. Oh, Paul, Festus said, I'll be there. Nothing's going to happen to you. It's just what the Jewish leaders wanted. But Paul could not get out of his mind that word that came to him from Christ himself. Paul, you're going to get to Rome. Let's go back and look at that word again in chapter 23 and verse 11. And the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, Be of good cheer, Paul. For as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. That was what Paul had in his mind. And he knew he could not agree to this proposal. So that brings me to the fourth thing in the passage, a confident appeal. Paul understood the law, and he understood the concept of jurisdiction. And Paul said, I can only be judged at Caesar's judgment seat. I'm standing, he said, at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. What was Paul doing? He was pleading his right as a Roman citizen, notably as a free-born Roman citizen. He was pleading his right. This was not something he purchased. It was something with which he was born. He had had it all his life. He was pleading his right, saying, I have the right to be judged at Caesar's judgment seat. And only in that place would he consent to be judged. He said, if I'm guilty of a crime, I do not refuse to suffer punishment. But he said, if I am not guilty of any of these things, not you, Festus, nor anyone else can deliver me to the Sanhedrin. I appeal unto Caesar. It was obviously a formal wording which he knew very well. And no doubt which he had considered very well. I appeal unto Caesar. It was the opportunity to get to Rome. There was a church in Rome. He longed to meet the people there. And there was an opportunity to preach the gospel in Rome. Now it appears that when Paul made his appeal, Festus must have been somewhat surprised because he doesn't respond. He didn't respond immediately. He got his counsel together, his advisors. What are we going to do about this now? So they would say to him, he has a right as a Roman citizen to be heard by the emperor. So he said, all right, you've appealed to Caesar. You're going to go. Now, those were happy words for Paul, but Festus didn't mean them in that way. Festus meant, you don't have any idea what you're getting into. But there again was the case where a man who has the word of God in his mind has much more knowledge of what's happening than Festus seated on the judgment seat. Paul was asserting the jurisdiction to which he knew that he was entitled, And he did so in the assurance that he would preach the gospel at Rome. The message that he had preached everywhere he had been, even when he was in custody, we are sure. That was the message that he was going to preach at Rome. We know it is so because for 2 years in Rome, he preached the gospel to everyone who came in to see him. And it was all for the glory of Christ. So what seems to us a very technical consideration, a question of jurisdiction, yields to the much greater consideration of the glory of Christ. That's what Paul's mind was on, the glory of Christ. And it was the providence of God in arranging the details of Paul's life and his citizenship that gave him this opportunity. Let us observe Paul's example. Even here, he was not in panic. Even here, he was not in desperation. Even here, he knew that at the end of the day, Christ was his master, and he was in his service and called to deliver his gospel. Ultimately, that is our situation as well. Christ is our master. We are in his service. And whatever the forces of wickedness in the world may have to say about it, they cannot overcome that reality. So let us live today in that reality. We serve the Lord Christ, and we will go where he sends us.